Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how free are you in Texas? Not very, according to the Cato Institute. We find out why. As courts hear challenges to the Texas anti-abortion law, pro-choice advocates are preparing for the end of Roe. And voting in Texas is different in 2022. We get the details on what you can expect. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A big part of the Texas brand is being a state where you can be free and enjoy a heapin' helpin' of personal liberty. Turns out that's more hat than cattle. The conservative Cato Institute released a ranking of states for personal freedom, and Texas comes in second to the last. California outperforms Texas on this list. To find out more, I spoke with Jason Sorens of the Cato Institute.
Freedom in the 50 states is an effort to rank all governments, state governments' respect for individual liberty. And we define liberty as your ability to use your life, liberty, and property as you see fit, so long as you don't infringe on others' rights to do the same. So we call that the maximum equal liberty principle. And we understand that freedom isn't the only thing that matters, but we think that everyone cares about freedom to some extent. And so we measure that aspect of justice and the good life, that is the extent to which state governments afford their citizens freedom. And we look at both economic and personal freedom. So we look at taxes and how much of the economy government consumes. We look at business regulations, regulations on property owners. We also look at personal freedoms, criminal justice, lifestyle issues.
So in Texas, people think we're a very free state. That's not what you found.
Yeah, we found a very mixed bag in Texas. Texas is great on some measures and quite poor on other measures. So Texas is typically, in our study, not done well at all on personal freedom. It's one of the worst states on personal freedom, but also one of the better states on economic freedom. It's a low tax state. It doesn't regulate labor markets very much, and that has helped create a dynamic economy that has attracted people from around the country. At the same time, it's also imprisons more people than any other state, adjusting for crime rates. And it also has some cronyist regulations and some limitations on things like educational freedom that you might not expect from a state like Texas. And so we definitely see some areas for significant improvement.
Which state did you find to be the most free?
We found New Hampshire as the freest state this time. But really, New Hampshire and Florida are both really close. Last time, Florida pipped New Hampshire to the post, and this time it went the other way. Both of those states have increased a lot over time, and they continue to vie for that number one spot. They're both low tax states, pretty low regulations on business, and they also are both above average for personal freedom.
New Hampshire, it has 400 representatives in their state house, which is astonishing. I was wondering if that reflects the level of freedom, because there seems to be a lot of representation.
I think that can be a cause of the level of freedom. I'm not sure that at least 20 years ago, before New Hampshire started to get a lot of attention for its level of freedom, that that the citizens of New Hampshire were especially pro-freedom. But I think the institutions of the state, the way government is set up, helped promote freedom. Part of that is the largest legislature in the English-speaking world on a per capita basis, as you noted. It really has made it easy to get elected, and it has a true citizen legislature. It also has a unique executive council that helps provide a check on the executive branch. They can veto government contracts on a number of government policies. And it's also one of the most decentralized states in the country. So about two-thirds of the tax burden in New Hampshire is raised at the town level, and towns are open to town meeting. So you have direct democracy at the town level, where the vast majority of the tax burden is found, and so you get a lot more citizen control of government there.
When you look at freedom from the Cato Institute's point of view, do you look at reproductive freedom?
We do, and we understand that different people are going to interpret that differently. So for some people, freedom is respecting the fetus's right as a person to be born. For other people, it is respecting the potential mother's right to her own body to have an abortion. And some have a lot of people, I think, have a kind of in-between position. So they might say, well, maybe the fetus gets rights at a certain point, like in the last trimester or something like that, which is sort of the standard that Roe v. Wade has, viability. And so we create three different abortion indices on the basis of whether you're pro-life, you're moderate pro-choice, or you're strong pro-choice. And so we also provide alternative versions of the Freedom Index based on all three of those assumptions. In the main headline numbers, we don't include abortion at all because we don't want to take a stand on that for the headline numbers. But you can dig into the study, and depending on what your views of abortion are, you can find a Freedom Index that's suited just for you.
Texas has limited abortion, and it is the state that has limited it the most, restricted it, almost banned it. Does that rate on its Freedom Index?
It does not affect its overall Freedom Index. So Texas is really, really low on personal freedom, even if we don't include abortion.
What about voting rights? Our founders, which Cato Institute pays a lot of attention to, they really thought that liberty and freedom hinged upon being able to vote for them if you were white male landowner. But, you know, we've broadened that since then. Texas is the most difficult state to vote in. Does that weigh on the Freedom Index?
Yeah, that's a good question. We do collect the data on that, but we don't include it in the Freedom Index for a very specific reason, which is that we see voting rights as an opportunity to participate in government. And that can be extremely important and maybe instrumental to getting freedom, but we don't see it as a part of freedom as we define it, which is your ability to use your own life, liberty, and property without hurting others. And so we don't include it in the Freedom Index for that reason, but it's nevertheless an important area of state policy.
So, but you do look at things like what being able to buy a beer on Sunday morning. What are you looking at?
Yeah, we do. We do have that, actually. We have a lot of different policies. So we have, on the fiscal side, we have taxes, government employment, government consumption, government debt, the financial assets that could offset government debt. We, on regulatory policy, we look at things like zoning restrictions, where Texas does very well, rent control.
So we say that in Texas that business owners can make a lot of decisions about who they hire, and a lot of people work at will for those businesses, right?
That's correct.
Except when it comes to COVID.
Okay, so explain that to me a little bit.
So Texas prohibits businesses from having a vaccine mandate.
Oh, right. Yeah, and we would see that as anti-freedom. Because the end date for our data is the beginning of 2020, we don't have any of those COVID policies in the index itself, but we do have a chapter of the study. You can download it at freedomthe50states.org, where we talk about COVID restrictions. And we note that, you know, some states on the left have been really restrictive with mask mandates and things like that, but some states on the right have been also really restrictive in banning vaccine mandates for private sector employers, small businesses, for their customers, or cruise lines in Florida. And that's also a restriction on freedom.
Jason Sorens is the co-author of the Cato Institute report, Freedom in the 50 States. For personal freedom, Texas is ranked 49th. Texas is one of the worst states for reproductive rights. In the last legislative session, SB 8 was passed, which essentially is a complete ban on abortion in the state. On Friday, the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals heard a challenge to SB 8. The legal issues brought before the Fifth are extremely technical and narrow, but at stake is whether abortion providers will have any shot in the coming months to get an order that would at least partially block enforcement of the law. The anti-abortion law has been in effect now for more than 4 months in Texas. Pro-choice advocates say it's clear that Roe v. Wade is likely to be reversed, and they need to prepare for what that's going to be like. Dr. Deborah McNabb is a retired OBGYN and abortion provider in San Antonio.
Women have always had abortions. Women will always have abortions. The only question is, will those abortions be safe and legal? It appears to me that the Supreme Court is going to undo 50 years of precedence. Roe v. Wade and Pennsylvania v. Casey are going to be overturned. And then it will go back to the states, whereupon more than half of the states are very likely to criminalize abortion. Again, we know that women will continue to have abortions, and women will be able to go out of state. But in order to do that, you have to be able to take a day or two off of work, which most women cannot afford. You have to arrange childcare. You have to arrange your travel and pay for that, and maybe a hotel stay, all of that in addition to paying for the procedure itself. Now, we know that about 3/4 of women who have abortions are either at the poverty level or they're just making ends meet. That means that 3/4 of women in Texas will not be able to obtain an abortion, but the other quarter of women who have money will be able to. So we're going to see women in the underprivileged groups suffer and die because of these laws.
You're basically telling us, probably this is what a lot of people are beginning to understand, that abortion care in Texas and probably at least 26 other states where they have laws on the books that will begin to that go into effect immediately once Roe v. Wade is overturned, that will end access to abortion in these states. This is something that just reading the writing on the wall with the Supreme Court and what's happening with this Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, that we need to be aware that this is probably what's going to be happening here in Texas. And that this claim that ending a legal abortion does not end abortion, it just creates a world where it becomes unsafe.
And there's, you know, there's no memory in the general public about what the bad old days were like. I was a sophomore in high school when the Roe decision came out in January of 93. So I have a little bit of understanding in real life what it was like before. But in medicine, the men, and they were all men, basically, the men who were training or who were in practice in those days before Roe v. Wade, they experienced emergency rooms full of women who were injured and or dying from illegal abortions. But those men are now either retired or deceased. For example, in San Antonio, our medical school here was relatively new. And so I actually met the original chair of the OBGYN department when I started residency in 1984. He retired at that point, and the second chair came. So they had recruited the founding chair from New York, and the second chair came from New York. And those men had had those experiences in person, and they refused to turn their backs on women. So the second chair was Dr. Carl Powerstein, and he told me, at that time, Bexar County was in charge of the public hospital. Dr. Powerstein told me that every year he went in front of the Bexar County commissioners and explained to them why abortion care was essential. And then later, the state became the entity in charge of all of the public medical schools in Texas, and the state said that the medical schools could no longer provide that training and provide that care. That's when Planned Parenthood in San Antonio began to provide abortion care, because we had sent all of our patients to the county hospital. And we felt like we did not have another place where we could send our patients that provided the quality of care that we wanted to see. So we don't have an institutional memory. We don't have a memory within the medical profession, individual physicians, and we don't have a memory as a society. I was talking to a young medical student recently, and I said, you know, it's going to take a number of deaths for people in the country to wake up and see what has happened, because people have taken it for granted for generations now. And she responded, it's going to take a certain kind of death. And what she meant was, as long as the people who die are poor, black, brown, they are invisible. Their deaths will be relatively invisible. It's only when middle-class white women start to die in significant numbers. And again, most of the women who want to have an abortion are in that category, that invisible category. So it's going to take quite a while for society to wake up.
Now, there are ways of accessing abortion care, I guess, through underground means. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, or if it's gutted in a way that is basically overturned, there are organizations like Plan C and Aid Access that people can go online and receive the medication for medical abortion. But unfortunately, these organizations have shown that there's not a lot of Americans that have actually heard of Aid Access or Plan C. Do you think that more people will be hearing more about Aid Access and Plan C in the future?
Well, I believe so. But as you know, Senate Bill 4 in Texas has made that illegal. And I imagine that many of the states that criminalize abortion will do the same thing. So in Senate Bill 4, even though it's very safe, as long as a woman knows that she's within a certain number of dates of her pregnancy, she has to be within 10 weeks gestation in order to have a safe, effective medication abortion. But as long as she knows where she is in the pregnancy, having a telehealth appointment and getting the information and getting the medication through the mail is safe. But our state government has said that they will charge anyone who provides that medication with a felony penalty. Now, there is, many people might say, you know, well, that's never going to happen. They can't enforce that. But history tells us that they can. In the 1980s, in New York State, they were sending, different organizations were sending information about contraception and about sexually transmitted infections through the mail. And they were also sending condoms in the mail. And there was just this regular guy named Anthony Comstock who decided that these materials were, quote unquote, obscene. So he started a campaign about this, and he eventually got a position with the Postal Service. And there were laws called the Comstock Laws, named after him, and they intercepted mail all the time. And anyone who sent these materials went to jail. A whole lot of people went to jail for this. And that wasn't overturned completely until Griswold v. Connecticut in 1965, I think that was. So all it would take, I don't think at the state level they could really enforce that, but all it would take would be a president to issue an executive order and a postmaster general to carry it out. And that could happen.
Right. But for the time being right now, Plan C, Aid Access, two organizations that are saying they will be doing what they can to send this material for medical abortions into Texas if women contact them online and begin communication. But they need to know that Aid Access and Plan C exist.
Absolutely. And those providers will provide it as long as they can get by without being criminally charged.
Dr. Deborah McNabb is a retired OBGYN and abortion provider in San Antonio. It's a new year, and there are new voter laws in place for elections in 2022. It's important that citizens who want to vote in Texas understand the new limits and opportunities that exist. Grace Germain is the president of the League of Women Voters of Texas.
The way the public participates in our democracy has a few tweaks and a few changes, and some of them are really good, and we're really trying to promote those. So one of the really good things that's happening is that we have a new vote-by-mail tracker system. The Secretary of State hasn't published it yet, but it will be coming out sometime in January. So that is fantastic news. One of the not-so-good news that goes by vote-by-mail is that voters need to fill out this new application to vote by mail. And this new application has a section on it that says that is about your voter ID number. And you just need to really be careful and put in the correct, a good voter ID number. And that voter ID number needs to be the same you'll use the same voter ID number for your ballot, your vote by mail ballot too.
Where do I get my voter ID number?
Well, it'll be your driver's license number or your personal ID number. And if you don't have one of those, it'll be the last four digits of your Social Security number. And so it explains it on the vote by mail application.
It used to be that the county would send me a voter vote by mail form, right?
The counties used to be allowed to mail out to the voters who normally participate in vote by mail because they're over 65 or they're disabled and they wish to vote by mail, and that's how they normally participate in our democracy. Now each voter will need to contact the county in order to get them to send them a vote-by-mail application. Or you can go to the county website.
Some people are used to getting every year, at the beginning of the year, from the county that form that they could fill out and just send it right back in, and that they could vote by mail. But they're not going to get that anymore. And that's probably a messaging thing we need to figure out.
Right. They will not be getting that. Now they won't be getting it from the county. If a political party wants to send it to them, then they can. That is not against the law. But the counties are not allowed to send out applications to vote by mail. So voters just need to step up, get online, I guess, or contact their local League of Women Voters, get that new voter vote by mail application.
There's also been talk that the county election registrar office is not even really allowed to promote the fact that you can vote by mail.
They can put the information on their website. That is not illegal. What they can't do is say, would you like to vote by mail? They can't offer, when they're out registering voters, they can't also give people an application to vote by mail. And so they could have it there. And if a person requests one, request is the term that they're using. If you request a vote by mail application, then the county will send you one. But if you don't request it, then they will not send you one and they will not talk about it.
It's like having something really delicious in a restaurant, but they can't put it on the menu, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to know the secret item, like they have the best borracho beans in the world, but they're not going to tell you about it. But you have to go in there and be in the know and order it, and then you can have it.
Yes, you have to ask that waiter, say, what is that best thing that you have on your menu? Just like you have to ask your county election office for your application to vote by mail.
Right now, vote by mail application deadline for the upcoming March 1st primary. The deadline is February 18th.
Yes, that's right. But don't wait for that deadline, because everything takes longer with the mails nowadays. So please call up or email your county election administrator, get that application to vote by mail and fill it out if you're eligible. Oh, did you know that there's a new group of folks that could vote by mail? It's people who are expecting to give birth within 3 weeks before and after election day. Now, those people would only be able to apply for that specific election. But it's kind of exciting to have something new there.
Right now, the Texas Secretary of State, Scott, has begun a process of where they are going through the voting rolls. Some people are calling it a purge, and they are looking at potential non-U.S. citizens canceling their registration to vote. And the League of Women Voters has been looking at this. And are you concerned about this process?
So this process started in September, and it's a new process that they created, and they said that they were following all the rules that were set in place with the lawsuit that we won. But my concern is I just think this is finding way too many people who are actually naturalized citizens, and they're receiving these letters in the mail saying that they have to prove their citizenship in order to maintain their voter registration status. They're just finding too many. Something's the matter with the process, and the Secretary of State needs to review that process to really make sure that they are not disenfranchising all those naturalized citizens who register to vote.
So there are naturalized citizens, newly naturalized citizens, and they will be getting letters in the mail telling them some questions about their registration to vote. I can imagine that would be pretty scary to me.
Right, especially if you're so excited, you're a newly naturalized citizen, and you want to participate in the democracy, and instead you get this letter in the mail saying, we're just not sure you're a citizen, so you have to prove your citizenship to us. So the issue is, why are they being tagged or flagged as non-citizens? Why do they have to prove their citizenship? Is the way that they're finding those folks, is there something the matter with that process? I think they need to look at their process again.
Last year, 2021, the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, they spent $2.2 million looking for a voter fraud in the state of Texas, and they were able to close three cases. That sounds like they're spending almost $1 million per case for a voter fraud.
I think that is ridiculous, and I think that the reason why it is ridiculous to spend that much money is because it is an issue that obviously we don't have much of a problem with. And I know that there's some folks out there shouting voting fraud all the time, and it's just not true. We have a very good systems in place that each county follows to make sure that the voting rolls are accurate. And actually, the Secretary of State's audit that they just, the first phase of their audit has really, you know, shown that those four counties they're auditing have done a great job.
So, Grace, there is a positive development when it comes to registering to vote in Texas, or if you have changed of address, now you can go online.
Right. Now you could, if you're already registered to vote, you could go online at texas.gov and hopefully soon votetexas.gov and update your voter registration online. And that is a great new tool that voters have available to them. Otherwise, you would have to fill out a new voter registration card and turn it in physically. But this is a great new tool for voters to use. If you're already registered to vote and you moved or you changed your name, then you could update it online. It's a great tool. And remember, the last day to register to vote or update your voter registration is January 31st in order to be ready for those Texas primaries in March.
Grace Germain is the president of the League of Women Voters of Texas. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. For past Texas Matters episodes, go to our website, tpr.org, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.